Earlier this summer, I read a book titled A Little Manual for Knowing by Esther Lightcap Meek, and it was so good. I started reading it while I was on a 5-hour flight, and after I had read about 3 chapters or so on that flight, I just had to stop. I pulled out a notebook, and I wrote out about 2 pages of notes, just thoughts that were pouring out of me. I was thinking about things like surrendering to what is real as opposed to what we wish were real. I was thinking about the importance of listening so as to truly know how God is inviting us into the real. I was thinking about things like what it means to know another person and that the only way to do that is to submit to who they actually are, rather than to who we want them to be, or to try to get them to be something and then know that person who doesn't actually exist. So I finished reading A Little Manual for Knowing later that week, and I just thought to myself, man, I have to get Esther Lightcap Meek on this podcast. And so I reached out to her, and here she is. Now, let me just say that Esther is brilliant. I think I had to work harder in this interview to keep up with my guest than I ever have in any other interview. And so this episode is a little bit longer than most of my episodes, but let me say that it is so worth it. You will probably also have to work a little bit to keep up with Esther as well, but you will also be delighted by the way that Esther talks about how we know things, which is a gift from God. So, without further ado, here is Esther Lightcap Meek. I'm Marcus Watson, and this is episode 46 of Spiritual Life and Leadership. All right, I'm here with Esther Lightcap Meek, who is the professor of philosophy at Geneva College and the author of a book I just read about a month ago called A Little Manual for Knowing. Hi, Esther. How are you?
Fine, Marcus. How are you?
Good. I'm doing great. Thanks so much for being here. I'm excited to be able to talk with you. We'll hear a little bit. We'll get into our conversation, but I just want to get to know you a little bit with some of these get to know you questions that I like to ask at the beginning. And so, Esther, the first question I want to ask you is, what job would you be terrible at?
Can I relate that to one of the other questions you're
Yeah, sure,
ask?
Sure.
So the second question is...
Right. The second question I was going to ask you was, what would a mirror opposite of yourself be like? Is that the one you were thinking of?
All right. So yeah. I thought about that.
Okay.
The answer to the job, the terrible job, would be the one that involves the mirror opposite qualities.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Okay. So that's what I'm thinking.
We can put those together.
So I'm a very intense person. So the opposite of me would be the opposite of intense. So what would that be? So that'd be laid back, maybe?
Okay.
Indifferent.
Oh.
I'm also not really good at cynicism.
Mm-hmm.
And then I tend to be excitable.
Okay.
So also intense and excitable. So the opposite of that, a job that would require me to be either indifferent, or you know what? I can add the word sophisticated. I don't think of myself as particularly sophisticated.
Okay.
I just can't pull it off, you know?
Funny.
Professional, you know, when I've tried to be professional, somehow that hasn't exactly worked for me either.
So
would be jobs that I'd be terrible at, or if I was trying to be those things in my job, the job would not go well until I gave up.
Funny. I would never have guessed any of those things.
But I also think that I'd be terrible at, I tend to think of myself as not somebody that you want to have for a nurse.
Mm.
And maybe if you're a 2-year-old, you might not want me as a caregiver.
Okay. Why is that? Why do you say that?
I think ordinary helping sorts of things, and I don't ordinary. It's more concrete, physical helping
Okay.
things are not the sort of thing that
Right.
I
Okay.
particularly excel in. Does
Okay.
that make
Yeah.
sense?
Yeah. Okay. But you can help people think
Now,
through things.
right.
Yeah.
If the child wants to have a thoughtful conversation, I'm there.
Cool.
The same with the person in the bed. Yep.
Okay. Good. So you can sit by their bedside and talk with them,
Right.
but
Right.
don't expect you to draw
Yeah.
blood or,
I
give
think
them
I'm the
shots.
queen of conversation.
Okay. Awesome. Well, good. That's great because this is a podcast and we're having a conversation. So that's fantastic. Good. Hey, and then the third question I have, part of the reason I wanted to ask you this is because I don't always ask the same three questions. I kind of have a variation here. I asked another podcast guest named Mandy Smith in, I think it was episode 36, what's the most formative book she's ever read? And she said, A Little Manual for Knowing, or at least this was the most formative book in the last several years. And that's how I got turned on to your book. But I'd love to know what's the most formative book that you've ever read, or a one of the most formative, let's say that.
Well, I thought about this, and I thought of one per decade.
Oh,
So
wow.
let's see if I can do this
Yeah,
quickly.
okay.
Okay, 0 to 10. I didn't come up with one there, but in high school, it would have been Francis Schaeffer's "The God Who Is There."
Okay.
And these, I thought of these books just because they were books that like changed the course of my life in some way or other.
Okay.
So, and then the next decade would be the work of Michael Polanyi.
Okay.
And then the next decade, I was about 33 when I read a what is now an old book called "Finding a Job You Can Love."
That's cool.
It's still in print, and it has a test in it that really helped me figure out that I had been self-deceived
Huh.
about who I am.
Really?
So that was an eye-opening moment.
When was that? How long ago was that?
I was in my
Oh,
30s.
and you're 30. Okay, so not like in the last 2 years or whatever.
No. So
Okay.
then I this is not the kind of thing you're looking for, but in my 40s and my 50s, in a way, it was the two books that I wrote. So
Oh.
Longing to Know really changed the course of my life.
Mm.
And Loving to Know changed it again. So that would be 40s and 50s. And
Wow.
then that's opened up the best part ever in my 60s, where I've gotten connected with especially the work of D.C. Schindler. And so when I first found his work would have been 2014,
Okay.
so I would have been 61.
Wow.
And I just could not believe how it resonated with my own work, but just gave me all the depth dimension that I had only been skating on the surface of. And
Oh, wow.
so I felt like eternity opened up for me, and I was on the beginning of a adventure that would take me into eternity
Yeah, wow.
and has me very, very excited.
That's
So,
cool. So,
how's that?
yeah, that's great. Do you have any? So, for Polanyi, you mentioned Polanyi and Schindler, just their works in general. Do you have any
Sure.
particular books you'd recommend or?
Well,
Oh.
the first Polanyi book I read was Personal Knowledge,
Okay.
which is his magnum opus. It was his Gifford Lectures, and that was really the book that helped me identify that he was presenting me a viable area of study for my dissertation. And then, that was kind of a pragmatic sort of a thing, but it really, obviously, Polanyi's work contributes the epistemology that I've adopted and adapted in my own work. So, and then D.C. Schindler, the first piece I read was, it's actually chapter two in his book called The Catholicity of Reason, and the essay is called Surprised by Truth, and it's actually out there online.
Okay.
So that was my first
Okay.
moment of
Okay.
reading. That was when I fell out of the kitchen chair onto the
Wow.
floor.
Wow. Awesome.
There
Well,
also another thing to look at online that I did early on was David has a, there's a YouTube out there of something called The Last Lecture,
okay.
which he gave at when he left Villanova and went to John Paul II Institute
okay.
in DC. And the title of the lecture is called Wonder, the Final Word. And now that I teach his books in my philosophy for theology class, that's what I make the students look at the first day.
Oh, cool.
It's the
cool.
Wonder Lecture.
And sorry, who was that, did you say? That was...
Misty Schindler.
So that was Schindler. Okay, okay.
Yeah.
Wow, cool.
He's a young man that I'm proud to now have as my friend.
Really? Oh, yep. That's awesome. Awesome. I'm going to have to look into some of these books for sure.
Well, the neat thing about the Wonder Lecture is, and this is why I have my students look at him, is this young man exudes ardor. I can't think of another person about whom I would use that word ardor. But he practically glows.
Wow.
And I, you know, I'm a fan.
Oh, well, I'll put a link in the show notes for that. I'll find the Wonder Lectures and put a link there, and hopefully people can find that and watch that. Is it on YouTube or something like that?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes,
okay.
It is.
Okay,
and
good.
I think it would be, you would go to, you would look for Villanova,
okay.
The Last Lecture. I'm not sure that that Wonder, the Final Word, would turn it up.
Oh, okay. Okay. Last Lecture. All right. All right. Cool. Well, cool. Well, yeah, good stuff. So let's talk about, I want to get into your book, the one that I read about a month ago called A Little Manual for Knowing. And this is a book about epistemology. Is that, would that be correct to say that?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I think it's a little bit bigger than epistemology.
Okay.
Yes, it's about knowing, but it also, I feel as if covenant epistemology has a vision of not only knowing, but being. And
okay.
and so it's knowing that kind of opens into all of your life. And I think that's been true of all of my books, but I think it's true of Little Manual.
Okay. And just can you, for those who aren't sure what epistemology is, I know it's more than that, you said, but what is that? And then I want you to define epistemology, and then you mentioned covenant epistemology. Can you say what you mean by that? Yeah.
So... philosophy? Can I start with
Start with that.
Yeah. Okay. So philosophy concerns the fundamental questions of life that everybody lives responses to. And it seems to me that everybody has just by virtue of being human. So I say that there's one requirement. You need to be philosophical, and that's to be born. So it's your birthright as a human to wonder about the meaning of life, who you are, what reality is, and how we connect with it. And so those are dealing with those fundamental questions is what philosophizing is.
Okay.
And so when you're asking the question, so how do I know? Like, how do I understand the world? How is it that I can understand the world? How does knowing work? All of those. That area, when it's officially studied, is called epistemology, which is the study of knowledge.
Okay.
And so I, as you, I'm sure you're going to ask me my story, but
sure, yeah.
For me, I just couldn't get past the question about how do I know, because I was a baby skeptic. And so if you raise questions about that seem to be skeptical questions, that's a question of epistemology.
Okay.
So that's epistemology. Do you want to go on there or do you want me to say something about covenant?
Well, I do want you to say something about it, but if your story is a part of, if that helps, go ahead and like tell your story now, if that helps us understand what covenant epistemology is. Yeah.
My story is that, I grew up a good little Christian girl and then along about eighth grade, found myself with these questions that I felt must be sin. And they certainly seemed that I had no answer and needed an answer desperately. And the questions were, how do I know that God exists? And secondly, how do I know that there is a world outside my mind? And I felt the questions were sin, so I didn't tell anybody. Okay. But it seemed like the answers to them were essential, and that I didn't have them, and I had no proof. Hmm. And, you know, I really, you know, if those were my questions, I have to say, it's almost as if my story is a quest for reality. Hmm. And first of all, it was a quest for knowing.
Yeah, yeah.
I had to figure that one out, because it was, I felt that something was blocking me from reality. I had this presumption in connection with the second question that the only thing that I could be certain of, and I was certain of it, was the ideas in my mind.
Okay.
So the contents of my mind seemed, and this is just ludicrous, because other people are more certain what's in your mind than you are. I thought I was certain of only the contents of my mind, and just for that reason, they blocked reality from me. I could never get outside of my mind to see if they were true.
Okay.
Which, if you know anything about modernist epistemology, that's Carte Descartes, and that's what makes modernism.
Yeah, I think therefore I am. Is that it?
Yep, that's right. I mean, there
okay.
was,
yeah.
In a sense, I was not crazy. I was modernist, and that means I wasn't, and am still not alone.
There's
a whole pile of us in the modern West that have the same questions. And so I will never be out of a job, though I will maybe never be paid, not always be paid for it. But there will always need to be people that have to address that. Always.
Right. Okay. So what happened next? Like, how did that lead to your understanding of a covenant epistemology?
So the next installment was picking up the work of Francis Schaeffer, the God Who Is There. And I followed my mother's red pencil underlinings through that book in high school, which was no mean feat. And that was where I began to realize that my questions weren't sin, they were philosophical, and that responses to them had shaped whole cultural epochs across the disciplines. And that fired my imagination for something interdisciplinary, which is, I have to say, I'm so excited that these years at Geneva, I get to teach an interdisciplinary humanities course that directly grew out of Schaeffer's vision. So there's that.
Yeah.
So that was a stage. But at that point, I didn't know, I had no way of knowing, it seemed to me, that you could actually study philosophy. So it was the summer after my freshman year as a chemistry major that I met someone who was ecstatically telling me about his philosophy professor's classes. And it took me 12 hours to change the course of my life.
Wow.
It just seemed obvious to me that this is what I'd been looking for, and I was morally obligated to follow it because these were the most important questions.
Yeah.
So I haven't looked back from that moment at
that's
age,
cool.
whatever I was, 20.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's great. So and how did
that set me?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, go on. Yeah, that set you on.
The next part is that, you know, I pursued that because that was what I needed to pursue to respond to those questions.
Okay.
And I actually wrote a dissertation related to the second question, because reading Michael Polanyi was the only person that seemed to have been addressing the very question I had about reality.
Yeah.
And that's what I wrote on. But even at the point that I got my dissertation done, I was at sea. I just, if you had come out after me at that point and said, hey, let's have a conversation about epistemology, I would have run in the other direction.
Really?
I just thought, I know nothing. I know nothing. I know nothing.
Wow.
And so that was after the dissertation. So even though my dissertation was on realism, which means, yes, there is a world out there that we can contact, make contact with. I wasn't, it took me a while to be convinced. And I think having children was part of that.
Oh, interesting. You know, interesting.
They immersed me in reality in a way that only children can do. But so I found that over the intervening decades of life that I've come around. I've really come around, and it's partly as I've been able to write some of these things that it's been informative to me, because my books are for me my own like activity of discovery.
Yeah,
so
that's cool.
You know, what you're reading when you read my books are my, you know, string of, that's my quest and my aha moments. So
yeah,
that's why those books are important.
So
that brought me to the place of covenant epistemology. So I think I can define that now, if that's okay.
Hey, friends. Just like last week, technical difficulties. I lost Esther in the middle of what she was saying about covenant epistemology, but we're back after, way too long, 20 minutes. But we're back together, and I want to continue the conversation. So, Esther, now, kind of knowing a little bit about your story, tell us about covenant epistemology.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, in Longing to Know, I worked with Polanyi's idea of subsidiary focal integration, which it's fine for us to talk about at some point. And in my questions of life, I wanted to know about how we make contact with reality and how I know that I've made contact with reality. And that was the point of his the work that I did in my dissertation on the things that he said. Okay. And so I do talk about that in Longing to Know. And as I reflect on what that's like, growing out of some of the things that he said, it seemed to me that when we make contact with reality, it's like reality contacts back.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, reality may be contacted first.
Yeah.
And so there's this relationship, an unfolding relationship between the want to be knower and the yet to be known.
Yeah.
And so, and it's more one that's like a dance of overture and response. And so that is in essence the idea of covenant epistemology, that the best paradigm of great knowing would be the interpersonal covenantally constituted relationship. Actually, the best paradigm of that is the redemptive encounter, in which I have been transformatively known by the other, namely Christ.
Yeah.
So that's covenant epistemology.
Yeah. So let me just kind of reflect back. So covenant epistemology has to do with the relationship between the knower and the known, or the thing to be known. And you mentioned, just as a part of that reflection, you mentioned that we tend to be epistemological dualists, which I think relates to that, which I think has to do with I'm the knower, you're the known, and I am here to figure you out or it out. So covenant epistemology sounds like it has to do with a relationship, right, between the knower and the known. Which is different, right, than the way we tend to think about knowledge.
Yes.
We tend to think about knowledge as an object to be acquired, to be controlled, or
information to be gathered.
Yeah, information to be gathered. Can you just reflect a little bit on the difference between covenant epistemology and the way we tend to, like the typical way of knowing?
Right. And this is in Little Manual for Knowing, in that book, which is, I call that a how-to for knowing ventures in any field.
Yeah.
And it actually takes kind of the cream off of the top of Loving to Know.
In
eight motifs. There's a whole lot more in Loving to Know that I commend to you, but Little Manual has those eight motifs. But in any case, in Little Manual, I distinguish between the knowledge as information mindset, and the loving to know mindset. And so what I argue or try to help people see is that ordinarily when we think of what we're doing when we're knowing or what knowing is, we just think that it's information that we're collecting. And that's the prevailing dominant paradigm, and that's effectively our inheritance in the modern West. In modernist epistemology, we live in the information age, you know? And so the thing that you would do in knowing is gather it.
Yes.
So collect information. We like the word information. We like the word facts. We like the word data.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's just how, that's our default. I call it our defective epistemic default, because that's really, it's not true to what we're actually doing when we know. And, it's not as if you have to learn a new epistemology. What you have to learn to do is accurately self-describe what you've already been doing from the beginning. And so covenant epistemology does that. It's not giving you a foreign paradigm. It's helping you see what you were doing that kept you on the bicycle that you're riding.
Right.
So this has been with you as part of your life all along. And I'm sorry, I have to use big words to help you to see that. But once I do, you're going to be a better bike rider.
Yeah. Well, so you talk about, and I think you mentioned it briefly, subsidiary focal integration, right? Which is, I'll try to say what I recall from the book, and then you can flesh it out or correct it. But it's all those other things that you need to know in order to know the thing that you are trying to know. Yes, something like that. So with riding a bike, I like that illustration. Riding a bike, you have to know, which way to pedal the pedals, I guess. You have to develop some sense of balance. I don't know. Excuse me. Yeah, say more a little about subsidiary focal integration, what those other things that we need to know in order to know the thing that we really want to know, right?
Okay, I would like to kind of recast what you're saying when you say because, yeah, so when you're, just think about bike riding.
Yeah.
When you're carrying out the performance, what you're focused on is the performance, and actually you're focused on getting where you're going. But there's this wonderful thing called keeping your balance. And if you couldn't keep your balance, you would not be bike riding. But that keeping your balance is a bodied know-how. And you know the feeling of getting it right, because there's no other way to keep riding the bike. All right. Yeah. So what subsidiary of focal integration describes, what those three words describe, are this. You're integrating in the bike riding to the performance, the skilled performance of riding a bike. If you've got a focus, it's certainly not the bike. It's down the road. Okay.
Yeah.
And then what you're doing with the bike and your body, and even also the authoritative words of the person who taught you to ride, or, you know, the last manual you read on, you know, the Tour de France or whatever, is you're subsidiarily relying on all of that as a supportive level for the focal pattern. So a good word is indwelling. A good word is subsidiary, meaning it only makes sense in light of the pattern of what you're performing, but it's absolutely essential.
Yeah.
But it's subsidiary, not focused. If you revert to focus on your foot on the pedal, you would fall off the bike.
Right.
So you can't be focusing on subsidiaries. You can't do that because you need to be attuned to them in a subsidiary way as they bear on the pattern. So what Polanyi would say is that all knowing has that two level from two integrative structure. And your job is not to eliminate what you can't articulate, because you're relying on it. You know, there's no way that you can put words on keeping your balance and have that be identical with keeping your balance.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
Which, you know, raises a lovely, wonderful paradox for being a coach.
Oh, yeah.
Because you've got to say words that get your students' body to feel what's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Isn't that great? But all that subsidiary stuff is in no way a bunch of statements or facts.
Right.
It's not.
Right.
Now, you could articulate it like we're doing now, but that would be different, and it would not be the actual embodied know-how of subsidiary awareness that is keeping your balance on your bike.
Yeah, wow. And so how do we experience that in, like, when we're in a knowing venture, when we're trying to learn or know something new, like, how does that... And maybe we can think about, so let me set a context, give us a context to think about this. So I'm a pastor, and the world is different than it used to be. And I think it's harder for churches, like the churches are in decline. People don't go to church like they used to. The kinds of ministries and programs we used to do don't work the way they used to. People aren't, they're not, oh yeah, we got to go to the potluck this weekend, right? So... How can we apply this to, I think, what might be the church's knowing venture in terms of how do we be the church that we need to be for the world as it is today, rather than the world as it was 50 years ago or 100 years ago?
Mm-hmm. Can I just say, in response to that question, I believe that a lot of the difficulty that we've struggled with in the church just has to do with this faulty epistemology. And it's not just the church that has been kind of the wreckage of the Enlightenment. But I do feel, and because this is just what my story was in Longing to Know, this is just my story, that the reason I had problems with how knowing worked is that I had imbibed what everybody in the modern West imbibes, which is a faulty understanding of knowledge, on which knowledge is information. So then what the Bible is correct information. And what Christianity is about is amassing correct information. And that is intrinsically deadening and atheistic, actually. And it's,
well, why do you say that? Why do you say it's atheistic? Because it doesn't involve God in some way, right?
It actually blocks reality. Because here's the thing. If you back to the bike, if you focus on turning your handlebars, it actually blocks reality. And that's exactly what's happened in the modern West in Christianity, and it's also happened in science. So science has actually gotten in the way of good science, which is what Polanyi's point was, because science is no longer the quest for reality. Right?
Well, it's the quest. What would you say it's the quest for? What has it become?
Commodifiable, comprehensive data and information to the end of control and power, which is what Father Francis Bacon told us at the beginning of modernity.
Wow. And it, I think in a lot of many parts of the church, that's what it's become too. The commodifiable, not necessarily in terms of we want all your money, although sometimes that is, but just we want to look successful. We want to look like we got our act together. We want people to show up so we can feel good about ourselves.
Well, and the way that we see reality, this is how I've spent the morning reading, has just been the way we see the world, and I'm talking metaphysics here, which is the questions about what is really real, have been warped by modernity in a way that we can't even see what's under our nose. So the book I was reading is by Michael Hanby, called No God, No Science? and he's David Schindler's best friend.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So,
Now, is that K-N-O-W or N-O?
Let's see. No. Yeah. It's N-O. No. God. Okay. No science.
Okay.
Question mark. Okay. Yeah. And it's okay. Quite a tome, let me tell you. But okay. A lot of waiting to do there. Let me just go back to subsidiary focal integration and bike riding say that the way that we have construed knowledge in the modern West is that all knowledge is exclusively, exhaustively focal, not subsidiary.
Hmm.
And you see, with the bike analogy, that's the very thing that would disconnect you from reality.
Okay. Wow. Unpack that. I'm not quite sure I follow exactly what you're saying there.
Well, if you focus on your bike, you fall off the bike.
Right.
So if you're going to be a great bike rider, you need to be subsidiarily in tune with your bike. That means this kind of indwelling that you cannot articulate. That doesn't mean it's mystical. It's actually trainable, right?
Oh, shoot. Okay.
And it's absolutely essential for it to for reality to open to you.
Okay.
So, for example, I here in Steelers country, Ben Roethlisberger, as you know.
Yeah.
Focal knowledge would be Ben Roethlisberger standing on the 50-yard line, speaking the playbook or reading the playbook.
Oh, okay.
Now, that is so not what we pay him to do. And if he did that, no game would happen.
Right.
But if you want to see subsidiary focal integration, watch Steelers football. He's great at it.
Yeah.
And what is subsidiary? His men, his, you know, that line, you know, I don't know the lingo, but what is focal is making the play. And he's an innovator.
Right.
And so what he does is he bodily indwells the playbook so well that he can innovate.
Right. So,
now that's
okay.
Subsidiary focal integration, and that opens reality to you.
Yeah. And so now I'm going to transfer that to then the church and what God wants to do in the world. Like, we put so much of an emphasis on, you know, studying the scriptures, which is important.
Right.
But we say that good discipleship is knowing lots of things about God and about the Bible. And you know, we would also say being in relationship with God, but it has so much more to do in a lot of circles, I'd say many, many circles, about what we know, right? And less about how we live. Now, we would say, yes, it involves how we live in terms of, are you following the rules, right? The rules of Christianity or whatever. But there's not this language or this understanding of indwelling the scriptures or this relationship with God, like truly indwelling, so that, you know, when you're on the playing field, so to speak, of the world, playing the game as God has called us to play, living, being the people of God as God has called us to be. We get so focused on, do we know all the right things? Have we read the latest books? Have we acquired enough information to be able to, you know, be successful in the world as it is today? But that's all subsidiary. That's what I'm gathering. All that stuff is subsidiary. And the more we focus on these subsidiaries, do we have all the information we need in order to be the kind of church we need to be, the less we're going to actually be able to be the church and the people of God that we need to be, that the world needs us to be.
Okay. Close. Can I fix your language?
Okay, good. yeah. Okay.
Well, part of what's going on in what you're saying, I talk about in my books, and that is on the defective understanding of knowledge. And what can I just say? We're talking about the very thing that I feel that God has called me to do, which is, and I call it epistemological therapy.
Oh,
and what we have is these presumptions about knowledge that we don't even know we're living out of, and they're adversely affecting our knowing. Okay. And so one is the knowledge is information thing, but also connected to this defective understanding of knowing is we tend to make these divorces or these distinctions. So we've got, for example, reason and faith. That would be an example. Okay. Another would be theory and practice. Another would be knowledge and belief. Another would be reason and emotion. So I call this Esther's Daisy of Dichotomies. It's at the beginning of Loving to Know, but there's a little bit of little manual too. And so when I'm listening to you, Marcus, I'm hearing some of that Daisy talk.
Interesting.
Okay, so we generally, most of the people in the pew, they think what they're doing is they've got to collect Christian knowledge. And then what they have to do as a second step is apply it to their lives or live it out. And so the Daisy metaphor is that this is just to give people a sense of the feel of this thing. It's in the center of the Daisy that we put the members of the binary that we privilege. So yay, knowledge. Belief is more of a boo. It gets marginalized.
Okay, yeah,
so it's out
right,
on a pedal. Right. And all the things in the middle are privileged and connected with each other. So knowledge, science, fact, reason, objective, like that. So all of those are in the middle. And then their binaries are marginalized out on the pedals. Okay. Reason in the middle, art on the pedal, kind of like that. So, so theories in the middle, yay. And then after that, okay, some kind of action. Okay. So theory, so classroom or sermon or whatever, and then live your life.
Yeah.
And the galling thing about this, the saddest thing as far as I'm concerned, is when people say, well, the real deal is about your relationship with Jesus Christ. I mean, Jesus is the answer. He's the answer. But the trick is that we hear that on the pedal. And so our relationship with Jesus Christ is not, it doesn't have epistemic purchase as the main paradigm of how knowing works. Okay. So there's, I'm saying more in this than I'm, you know, I can unpack, I think in a matter of minutes. But we have marginalized our relationship with Jesus Christ. Here's another way that it comes about. If you want to tell your neighbor about Jesus, and this is just what Leslie Newbegin was saying, if you want to tell your neighbor about Jesus, what they hear is that you're asking them to check their brain at the door. So it's not about reason. You're calling them away from reason to faith. And so a lot of Christians have thought to themselves, well, Jesus is the answer. I'm just going to have to check my mind at the door.
Right.
Well, that's not really satisfying to a human made in the image of God.
Yeah.
Because you're being cut up in pieces. You are actually, all of this account of knowledge actually disconnects you from reality. It disconnects you from reality. Hmm. That's why I had the questions I did as a child. How do I know there's a world outside my mind? And it's not like I was reading it in the Bible. It's amazing what bad theology I was capable of as a child. But it's not like anybody in the pulpit was addressing my bad theology.
Right.
And what my bad theology was bad philosophy that I had inherited that blocked me from actually hearing and being transformed by Scripture.
Okay.
Now, honestly, Marcus, how can our churches be dead when you open the Bible and God comes and sets you on your ear? Like, what's up with that? When Thomas said, I'm preaching now, sorry. But when Thomas said, I will not believe until I stick my fingers in his wounds, and Jesus shows up and says, Thomas, stick your fingers in my wounds. Does Thomas say, oh, got that right, check?
Right. He says, my Lord and my God.
And he falls on his face. Now that's contact with reality.
Right.
That's when reality comes in and takes over, you know, you've made contact with reality.
Yeah.
Now, don't talk to me about correct information. You know what I'm saying? Mm. That's Ben Roethlisberger standing on the 50-yard line. Sorry.
Right.
I told you I'm an intense person.
No, that's great. That's awesome. So, let me just, for clarification or understanding, like, there's a place for correct information.
Here's the place. It is so good to memorize scripture, for example, but that is so not about correct information. What that's about is so that you can indwell it subsidiarily. Yes. The way to make information sing is subsidiary focal integration. It's not focusing on it. It's indwelling it. And can I just say, you know, switch to another stock example, reading. If you're focusing on the text as it looks on the page, you are not reading the book.
Yeah.
So what you are actually, Marcus, if you and your listeners are making any sense of what I'm saying, it's because you are subsidiarily indwelling my words. That's the only way meaning works.
Hmm.
And it's the only way you can make sense of anything. And if this is a meaningful world, the only way we can see it is not if we focus on information, but if we try to indwell it.
So, practically speaking, then, if you're a pastor or a church staff or elders, and you're trying to figure out, or you're trying to be who you were called to be. Okay, we're the church. Like, how does that? What do we need to stop focusing on? What do we need to, or what do we need to think of as subsidiary?
Yeah, right.
You know, I'm trying to make sense of this in a practical context. How do we live what you're speaking out?
I actually believe that having a little book club about knowing and reading, you know, longing to know or something like that would be a really big help, because we all do need this epistemological therapy. And without it, we can't redraw the playing field. And I haven't found any shorter way to help people do this than by teaching them over some hundreds of pages. What's up with this?
Right.
But what I find, Marcus, is that this is transformative. But then what that does is it frees you to see what you are actually doing as the church. And that's just what the Bible says. I mean, the church is the body of Christ. Why do we go to church? Because God comes. Our job or your job in conducting what happens on Sunday morning is to invite him to come and then to bear witness to his presence that he descends. And that's the Eucharist.
Yeah. 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 We should probably move towards a conclusion here. This is really good. So let me ask this. So in terms of our own, in order to be the kind of people who are open to reality, who invite the real, what kind of a posture do we need, towards reality?
Yes. Great stock examples from the Bible. Do not be like Zechariah. Do be like the Blessed Mother Mary. They ask the same epistemic question. How do I know?
Yeah.
Zechariah did it with a posture of his arms folded across his chest.
Mm.
Okay, I'm adding a little to the words of scripture.
Yeah, sure.
Mary, my gosh, was she open or what? She was just about to be impregnated by the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's the posture of Mary.
Yeah.
You know, let it be to me as you have said. You know, I already am the Lord's handmaid.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. That's the posture that invites reality, and God comes.
Yeah.
Don't you know, there's a lot of us that we're just so scared of God showing up.
Yeah.
Because it messes with our lives.
Right, right. Those postures reminds me also of in the Old Testament, you know, as the people of Israel were crossing the Red Sea, God often said, you know, don't be tight-fisted, be open-handed. Mm. That maybe captures that posture as well. Tight-fistedness is like, I want to, you know, it's grabbing, it's withholding, it's like it's a controlling kind of thing. Open-handed is give and receive, right?
I think generosity is right, but I think what we need to see is the generosity is of listening. So I've got this lovely bookmark right here on my desk with a quote from Simone Weil that says, attention is the rarest and purest form of generosity. And it's attention that we need. We have to show up and we have to listen.
That's good.
That's how we invite the real. And listening invites the real.
Yeah. Why don't we stop right there? This is great. I mean,
two more books, though, that you might consider in the context of the church.
Good.
Because I think they're really important and maybe doing something more like what you might be looking or, you know, related to mine.
Yeah.
And one is the work of Leslie Newbegin.
Yes.
So The Gospel in a Pluralist Society, the book that really helped me was his Proper Confidence, Faith, Doubt, and Certainty in Christian Discipleship. See what's the stock Newbegin movement starting a ringing challenge, and that is that people in the West can't even hear the gospel. And that's because something epistemological is stopping their ears. And he draws deeply on the work of Michael Polanyi to diagnose that and fix it. So he's using Polanyi. And then the second one is David Kettle. And David Kettle actually was Newbegin's successor. And he's got a book called, it's got a funny name, Western Culture in Gospel Context.
Okay.
And, it's got two subtitles that I'm forgetting. but that book could be a philosophy of ministry for a church for at least 10 years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So he talks about the gospel and conversion really in Polanyian terms of subsidiary focal integration. And he's the one I got the Zechariah and Mary contrast from. So he talks about radical attentiveness, the radical attentiveness that's absolutely essential to true knowing.
Yeah.
And knowing like ought to happen in good science and does happen in good science, which is what Polanyi knew. If you want to be a discoverer, you need to invite the real. You can't.
Yeah.
It's not about collecting certain information. If that's what knowledge is, he said, no scientific discovery could ever happen, but it does.
Yeah.
So fix your epistemology.
Yeah. Right. Wow, that's good. Let me just kind of in closing, if anyone wants to find out more about your books or you, is there anywhere they can go online?
Yes, thanks for asking. So I do have a website. It's called Longing to Know. It's very simple, and it does have brief descriptions of the different books that I've written that all have to do with knowing and reality. And then you can contact me through the website too.
Okay.
I also have an author Facebook page that you can like. That's Esther Lightcap Meek.
Okay. And there's a Facebook page that I found as well right after I read your book. I'll put a link to that in the show notes.
That's the author Facebook page.
Okay, good. All right. Well, hey, Esther, thank you so much for being on the podcast. And this is, man, I had to work harder than in any other podcast episode to keep up with my, you know, the person I'm talking to.
Not to mention the technology. That was...
We had a rough time. But hopefully by the time, all of our friends listening are listening, it'll only be slightly noticeable, but we'll see. I've got a lot of work.
Thank you so much for this opportunity, and I really do hope that it hits somebody where they are and can produce some fruit.
So I think that subsidiary focal integration is my new favorite expression. let me tell you a quick story. So a day or two after I had spoken with Esther, and in fact, it might even have been that very same evening, I was talking with my 14-year-old son, Micah. He came to me and he was holding his Rubik's Cube. Now, Micah used to be pretty good at solving the Rubik's Cube, something that I have never excelled at. But it had been about a year since the last time that he'd played around with it. So he showed me his Rubik's Cube and he said, "Dad, this is so sad. I can't solve it anymore. I can get this far, but I can't remember the last few moves to solve it completely." And you know, I gave him a concerned look and I said, "Oh man, what a bummer, Micah." Well, a few minutes later, he came back and he said, "Dad, look, I got it." I asked, "Oh cool, how'd you get it?" And he said, "Well, I just looked away and I let my fingers do the work and I solved it." And so I said, "Hey, you know what that's called? That's subsidiary focal integration." And Micah said to me, "Dad, you're such a nerd." Well, okay, he didn't actually say that, thank goodness, but he did kind of give me this look like, "I don't know what you're talking about." well, anyway, it's interesting. It's like I see it everywhere now. But one of the things that Esther said that really stood out to me was that radical attentiveness is essential to true knowing. Radical attentiveness is essential to true knowing. I think that means that if we want to know a subject, right, a subject of study, then we have to be radically attentive to it, not to what we want it to be or what we want it to mean, but to what it actually is. Right? If we want to know our spouse or our children, we have to be radically attentive to them, not to who we want them to be or wish they were. If we want to lead our churches to engage our communities in the way that God is calling us to actually engage our communities, we have to be radically attentive to the people in our church, to who they are, to who they actually are, not who we wish they were, to the people in our community, not to who we think they are or to what we wish they were. And we have to be attentive to God, really, truly listen to God. Well, if you would like to connect with Esther online, you can visit longingtoknow.com. And you can also visit her on her Facebook page, and I'll include a link to that in the show notes, as well as a link to longingtoknow.com. And then finally, if you haven't yet had a chance to leave a review for this podcast on Apple Podcasts, I would be so grateful if you would leave an honest review. The more reviews there are, the more likely this podcast will be found by others, and hopefully the more the blessing of this podcast will spread to those who need it. Well, thanks so much for being here, and I will see you next time here on Spiritual Life and Leadership.